Matthew chapter 6, which can be found on page 971 of the Church Bibles. That's 971, Matthew chapter 6. And we're beginning to read from verse 19. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy them, and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money.
A couple of weekends ago, I was listening to a senior mathematician from Cardiff University talk about one of his recent trips to lecture in universities in the former communist Eastern Europe. He'd actually just returned from a trip to Tbilisi, which is capital of Georgia. Now, his visits always follow the same pattern. He begins by giving a paper on his mathematical speciality. They then give a paper on their speciality. Everybody listens politely, claps, and asks questions. Then the academics that he's visiting ask him to talk about another field in which he is also an expert: evolution and Christianity. And he finds, you may not be very surprised by this, but he finds they are infinitely more interested in that than they are in mathematics. So much so that he's been asked back to Tbilisi to give 5 lectures on the subject to all the senior members of the faculty at the university. Now, he doesn't only just visit Eastern Europe, he also has a page every other week in the Russian equivalent of the Times Educational Supplement. The subject they ask him to write on, not the teaching of mathematics. No, they ask him to write every other week on the Bible and morality in schools. Can you imagine the Times Educational Supplement, those of you who are teachers, can you imagine it, the Times Educational Supplement, publishing such a topic in this country? It's unimaginable. And he is about to get a page in the equivalent of The Times every week to publish an article on something to do with Christianity. Now, all this is saying that in the former Eastern Europe, there is a profound spiritual hunger. And there is a profound spiritual hunger amongst intellectuals. And this is the result of 80 years of the ruthless enforcement of materialism by the communists. People have been taught that there is no God, no heaven, no hell. Material things are the only things that there are. But, as you've heard, many intellectuals no longer believe it. They've seen that it's been a humanitarian catastrophe, and they are beginning to see that intellectually it doesn't hold together. Hence the spiritual hunger. Now, before we get too smug, materialism isn't only a feature of communism. New York and London are just as committed to it. We may not be so much philosophical materialists, but we are practical materialists. Yes, if you ask us, many of us believe that there is more to life than we can see. I think it's about 90% of us say that we believe in God. But we live as though there isn't a God. We are practical materialists. Now, in this section of the Sermon on the Mount that was read to us just now, Jesus is addressing this issue of materialism. And what he says is very blunt indeed. He says it is impossible to follow him and be a materialist. Now, if you've been with us over the last few weeks here at St. Helens, you'll know that we're studying the Sermon on the Mount. And Jesus' overall theme has been that his followers are replacing the Jewish nation as the people of God. It is a radical message, and it's no surprise that he calls his followers to be radically distinctive. In their moral conduct, they are to be perfect, as their heavenly Father is perfect. That was chapter 5. In their religious activities, they are not to be hypocrites, but they are to have a heart relationship with their heavenly Father. That was the first half of chapter 6. Now, the second part of chapter 6 that we're on today, they are to be distinctive in their absolute rejection of materialism. And tonight I want to point to just three reasons that Jesus gives why his followers cannot be materialists. It would help me if you'd turn back to the passage. It's on page 971, if you haven't got it open already in front of you. First reason why Jesus' followers cannot be materialists. Materialism leads to despair. Verses 19 to 21. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Now, the first thing to say is don't misunderstand Jesus. He is not advocating a negative attitude to money, nor is he making a virtue of poverty. In the Bible, poverty is always spoken of as a wretched thing and something to be avoided if at all possible. Jesus commends diligence and hard work. Paul, in his letters, says that Christians must make provision for their dependent relatives and be generous if they possibly can. They are not to sponge off other people. They are to work hard if they can. So there's no criticism here of money itself. The key word here is treasure, there in verse 19. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth. Now that speaks not so much of money itself, but of our attitude towards it. Just imagine for a moment that everything is taken away from you. Your job, your home, your car, your bike if you don't have a car, your stereo, your TV, your video, your computer, your savings, your investments, your friends, your family, your education, your health, your nationality, your freedom, your faith. But, like Desert Island Discs, you're allowed to keep one thing. What will you keep? You thought? Well, that's your treasure. Because that's where your heart is. Look at verse 21. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Now, the follow-up question is this. Where is that treasure located? Is it located in heaven? Or is it located on earth? If your treasure is on earth rather than in heaven, you are a materialist. And ultimately, that will lead you to despair. Because Jesus says in verse 19 that corruption is built into all material things. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. It's the second law of thermodynamics, isn't it? Nature prefers disorder. Or in ordinary language, things always fall apart. The house will fall down. Remember that if you just bought a house. The fence will rot. Remember that if you've been putting up a fence this afternoon. The car will rust. That's very important to remember. The suit will wear out if it isn't scoffed by moths first. It is built into the very nature of material things that they don't last. I wonder if you know Shelley's poem about the ruined statue of the great Ozymandias that a traveller discovers in a pile of rubble as he's walking across the desert. On the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. See, corruption is built in, even into the mighty works of Ozymandias, They don't remain. They are just a pile of rubble in the sand a few centuries later. But perhaps even more profoundly here, Jesus says not only corruption is built into material things, it is built into the human heart. Don't store up for yourselves treasures on earth where thieves break in and steal. Now it's true, isn't it? There is always somebody wanting to have what we want. What we have. Determined criminals manage to get through locked doors and over barbed wire. They manage to get past dogs and burglar alarms and guards and security cameras. And then there are other people trying to get hold of what we have by legal means. Every week I'm offered a loan by somebody trying to get their hands on my money. Do you get those envelopes almost every week? And then just recently I've had the tax man trying to get his share of my money. And not even our precious metals are secure. Despite the very best efforts at the new regime at the Bank of England, the value of gold will be destroyed by inflation. It's absolutely certain. Absolutely certain. And even if we do manage, somehow, to secure the value of what we've got, what good will they be when we die? No use at all. Jesus told the story of a wealthy farmer who had a bumper harvest one year. He didn't have enough room to store all of his crops, so he tore down his barns and he built up bigger ones. When everything was safely stored away, he sat back and said, "You've got plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy now. Eat, drink, and be merry." But God said to him, "You fool. You fool. This very night your life's going to be demanded of you. You're going to die. Then who will get what you've prepared for yourself?" And the implied answer is that whoever got the inheritance, it wasn't him. He had to leave it all behind. Because wealth is useless beyond the grave. So do you see, Jesus' logic in verse 19 is irresistible. Storing up treasure on earth is a recipe for despair. If the moths and the rust don't get it, the robbers will. And if they don't get it, somebody else will when you die. So what's the alternative? Verse 20. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. Now, interestingly, at this point, Jesus doesn't go into great detail about what the treasures in heaven actually are. We're going to talk a bit more about that next week. But for today, and for just for this particular passage, Jesus is saying that storing up treasure on earth is a recipe for disaster. And we need to ask ourselves, am I living for treasure on earth, or am I living in some way for the life that's to come? Am I living primarily for this life, or am I living for heaven? Am I busy building up a fortune here and now, or am I most concerned to use it with heaven in mind? If we're simply building up a fortune here and now, it is a recipe for despair. But even more importantly than that, it is a recipe for darkness. Because Jesus' second little picture here shows that materialism leads not just to despair, it leads to darkness. The picture that he uses is the picture of the eyes. Verse 22. He says, "The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness?" Now the picture is fairly simple. Jesus is simply saying that the state of your eyes determines how well your body functions. So if you've got good eyes, undistorted vision, then you'll have a true visual perspective on the world, and your body will be able to function effectively. You'll be full of light, in Jesus' words. But if you have bad eyes, maybe short sight or astigmatism or something like that, then your vision will be distorted, your perspective will be wrong, and the functioning of your whole body will be affected. It will be full of darkness, in Jesus' words. Now, I know what Jesus is talking about. I went short-sighted when I was in my mid-20s. I first noticed a problem when I couldn't see the Greek on the blackboard at college. Now, I have to say that not being able to see the Greek didn't make very much difference to my learning of the language, but it did make a big difference on the rugby field, because I'd be playing, and suddenly I realized that somebody had kicked the ball towards me, and I just couldn't see it. And so I tried to catch the thing and made a complete idiot of myself, because I couldn't see it. I was too proud to admit it, and so tried to carry on playing for a number of months without saying anything. But eventually I did admit it, and I got hold of contact lenses. I'd like to say it made a difference to my rugby, but I think that would probably be stretching things as well. But the point is that my bad eyes had affected the functioning of my whole body, both intellectually and physically. Now, of course, Jesus is using eyesight as a metaphor for spiritual sight. Good eyes, in the Greek, are literally single or undivided eyes. And Jesus is saying the person with good eyes is the person who has their gaze wholeheartedly fixed on God, her heavenly Father. She is taken up with loving him, living for him, serving him. That sort of person has the right perspective on life. Her whole life is full of spiritual light. She's heading in the right direction, if you like. But bad eyes are literally evil eyes. This is the person who is so obsessed with looking at other things, so obsessed with storing up things on earth, that he never even glances at his heavenly Father. Such a person, in Jesus' language, is full of darkness. Now, Matthew uses this word darkness five other times in his gospel. And each time he uses it, it is a picture of spiritual darkness. It's a picture of God's anger and judgment. Three times Jesus uses hell as darkness as a picture of hell. He says that hell is a place of darkness where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. So that means that when he uses it here, darkness must mean that God is angry with those whose spiritual sight is fixed on someone or something other than him. Verse 23, if the light, that is the spiritual light within you, is darkness, how great is that darkness? If we're fixed on living for anything other than our Father in heaven, we are really in the dark. Now this means, you see, that materialism leads not just to despair, but also ultimately to God's judgment. George was raised in a village in Kenya. His parents weren't very well off, but he was clever, so they made big sacrifices to send him to school, to pay for the fees and the books and the uniform. He did well enough at school to secure himself a place at the university in Nairobi. Needless to say, George's parents didn't resent the extra sacrifices they had to make, and they were full of pride when they heard that 3 years later, their son was to graduate from the university. They got out their best clothes, which looked ill-fitting and shabby by the fashions of modern Nairobi. But nevertheless, they put them on and they caught the rickety old bus down to the capital city to see George gain his degree. They could think of no honour so great as to stand beside their son in his gown and his hood while their photograph was taken, and then to be introduced to people as George's parents. But 3 years in the capital city had changed George. He saw his parents coming towards him across the lawns of the university. And he saw how shabby they looked in comparison with all of his rich new friends gathered around him. They rushed up to him, thrilled to see their son after 3 years. But George completely ignored them. He walked straight past them, carried on talking to his friends. Well, now, that's just a small picture of how we have treated God. We have evil eyes, which are fixed on the treasures that we're storing up for ourselves in this world, but we avert our gaze and ignore our Heavenly Father, who's made us, cared us, given us the very things that we love so much. Now, if you want to know how God feels about our double-sightedness, half an eye on him, half an eye on the treasures of this world, Well, think about George's parents. We are full of darkness so often, facing God's anger. Well, then thirdly, what's the third picture Jesus gives? He says that materialism leads to divided loyalty. And here he is speaking of a slave attempting to serve two masters. Verse 24. No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. You see, behind the question of where we lay up our treasures, and behind the question of where we've got our eyes fixed, lies a still more basic choice between two masters. It's a choice between God and money. Literally, mammon, an Aramaic word that means wealth. Are you going to serve God, or are you going to serve your wealth? And a choice has to be made because it is a logical impossibility to wholeheartedly serve both. Just like you can't have two best friends. You can't have two lovers, even though people think they can. It's a contradiction in terms. You can't serve both God and money. But many, many people think they can. Some people think they can spend most of their time building up treasures on earth and then be nicely Christian as well. And I think this is especially challenging to those of us who would call ourselves Christians. The Christian businessman, for instance. Would he be prepared to take a job which would be far better for him as a Christian and maybe for his family, but it might mean a 60% cut in his salary? If that is the thing that prevents him from making the choice, he might, I'm not saying he is, but he might be serving two masters. What about the Christian student? Would she be prepared to do some sort of Christian work after college rather than immediately getting onto the career ladder? Well, if she would never consider it, she might be serving two masters. Or take the Christian worker like me. You may think I'm pointing the finger at other people. Well, I want to point it at myself. Am I prepared to leave my nice middle-class church, my nice middle-class friends, my nice home, to go to a much more run-down part of the country, or even abroad? If I'm not prepared to do that, well, I might be serving two masters. Or any of us here who call ourselves Christian, are we prepared to go anywhere for God, do anything for him, whatever it might cost us materially? Well, if we're not, we might be serving two masters. And just to make it even more painful, look what Jesus actually says in verse 24. It is very, very severe. He says, no one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. Now, the implication of that is that if we are putting our wealth before God, we are hating and despising God. Is that not a terrifying word? Someone may well say, well, what Jesus is asking of his followers is completely impossible. If Jesus' definition of materialism is correct, we all qualify on every count, whether we are Christian or not. We all lay up treasures on earth to some extent. We all have evil eyes, sometimes fixed on God, sometimes fixed on our treasures on earth. We all have divided loyalties between God and wealth. And that's quite correct. And I think that is the primary thing this passage is teaching us. That all of us, as we look at these verses, frankly, stand condemned. Do you know, there is only one person who has lived with his treasure only in heaven, with his eyes fixed 100% on God, with his loyalty completely undivided. And that, of course, was Jesus of Nazareth. If you read through these Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, you'll find that he lived a completely perfect life, utterly sinless in every respect, succeeding at every single point where you and I so often fail. But as you come to the end of the story, you'll discover that he died a most terrible death. Perhaps the most terrible death, certainly the most terrible death that anyone has ever died. Not just because he was pinned to a rough wooden cross by his hands and by his feet, if we can imagine what that's like. No, but because when he died, a strange thing happened. Darkness came over the earth at noon. Now, if you remember back in verse 23, do you remember what the result of having divided eyes are? It was being full of darkness. In other words, being under God's anger, God's judgment. What that means is that when Jesus Christ, this perfect man, died, he died under God's judgment, facing God's anger. A perfect man who never committed any sin, dying, bearing a punishment from God. This darkness, a sign that that is what was happening. Now, what this means is that when Jesus died on the cross, he bore in his broken body God's anger not against himself, he was pure and sinless, as we've seen, but against us, against our divided loyalties. He paid the punishment that we deserve to bear for our hatred and despising of God. He died simply in our place. He was living up to the name that he was given by the angel. Do you remember what the angel said to Joseph? You're to call him Jesus. And Jesus means the Lord saves. And that is precisely what he came to do. He came to this earth to save his people from the punishment that their sins deserve. He came to save you from the consequences of your materialism, your divided loyalties, your hatred and despising of your heavenly Father. Now, as you get to the end of reading this gospel, if you choose to, you'll be left with a question. Will you let him save you? His name is Jesus. He came to save his people from their sins. But will you let him save you and begin to reorientate your life around his values? If you won't do that, then you will have to spend this life and eternity trusting in your wealth, which will inevitably decay, which cannot go with you into the grave, and which will ultimately lead you to darkness. Because you will have to one day meet the God whom you have despised and hated. Now, just to go back to those academics in Tbilisi, they know that communist materialism has failed them. They know that it gives no hope for the present, nor for the future. And that is why they want my friend to come back and help them investigate Christianity further. But the question that occurred to me as I was listening to this lecture in mathematics was, how long will it take us capitalist materialists to come to the same conclusion? How long will we go on putting our trust in treasures built up on this earth? Once we start to think about it, it is absurd. It's hopeless. It won't do us any good for this life, and it certainly won't do us any good for the next life. So listen to verse 24 as we close. Jesus says no one can serve two masters. Either he'll hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to the one and he'll despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. I think it was Dylan who sang, you've got to serve somebody. Well, this passage leaves us with a profound question. Whom do you want to serve? And if you want to come back next week, you'll discover on how to live as a Christian rather than a materialist.